Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is The Guardian.
It is an insecure world in which we need to put in place measures that increase peace and security in our region. One of the lessons of the pandemic is, in general, we need to be more self-reliant. We need to be less vulnerable to international shocks, which might be a health shock through a pandemic, it might be a cyber issue, or it might be military conflict.
Hello, lovely people of podcasts. Welcome to the show. You're on Australian Politics with Catherine Murphy, and bizarrely, this week we are not in the pod cave. We are in a secret location.
You are.
The Prime Minister's looking at me with a fair amount of alarm at this point. Anyway, look, my guest, Anthony Albanese, Prime Minister of Australia. We're obviously having a chat because the parliamentary year is about to, start. Both bells, you know, with all bells on.
Really. Did it ever end?
No, but the parliamentary year, I mean. Obviously, obviously politics never stops, but the parliamentary year is about to start. And also, I spoke I can't remember how many occasions with the PM before he was the PM on the podcast. We used to have actually regular chats in the olden times about all kinds of interesting things. I don't think I've had you on the pod since you were PM.
You've rejected me, Catherine.
Well, I don't know about that. But anyway, I just think we've got lots to talk about. And I want to open the conversation not by plunging into a bunch of issues that we are going to plunge into in a little bit, but by talking about leadership more generally, because I reckon there'll be a lot of listeners who will be quite intrigued by how you've found the transition from being Leader of the Opposition to being the Prime Minister, what habits you might have picked up in order to help you manage an obviously really difficult, intense job. I think I want to get into the idea of ensemble leadership, which I think is what you've been trying to demonstrate really over the last 6 months, and that's quite interesting. So let's start. Just before we started recording, I reminded the PM that there was a great profile of Barack Obama a couple of years ago in Vanity Fair, which went to a lot of questions about how he managed the really intense job of being president. I just want to throw you a quote to start the conversation. So he spoke about the first night he slept in the White House after he was elected. So he said, "The first night you sleep in the White House, you think, oh, okay, I'm here. I'm sleeping here. Then in the middle of the night, you startle awake and there's this sense of absurdity. There's such an element of randomness in who gets to do this job." Then he says, he was a week into the presidency. Like, it took him about a week, and then he felt his body caught up with him, that he'd arrived, that this is the presidency, I'm here, this is really happening. On we go. So can you go back to the first night that you occupied one of the official residences and, like, what that was like, that sort of, oh, my God, I won?
I think I had a big advantage, which, of course, was not planned by me. The fact that the election was May 21, on May 23, I was sworn in at 9 a.m. as Prime Minister of Australia.
Yeah.
And by 12 noon, I was in the air on the way.
That's right. Yes, you were going to Tokyo. Yep.
In the prime ministerial plane. So the government plane has a meeting room on it, and I was briefed all the way up and all the way back from the head of defence, foreign affairs, people from the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet. I had so much to do in terms of briefings, and that made, I think, a short-circuited the transition. So that on day two, by the Tuesday morning, I was meeting with President Biden, Prime Minister Kishida, and Prime Minister Modi. I was clearly on the international stage, and that, I think, really helped to concertina
transition. Right, interesting.
And I think both publicly as well. Normally there's this period of who's going to do what job. We had a swearing in of five key ministers that first morning. That was a decision. There hadn't been the normal caucus processes and all of that slow dynamic that goes through. So I got back on the Wednesday evening and then back down to Canberra again. But I think that really helped. And as well, the public saw, oh, well, there's been a change of government. We had journalists with us, of course, on that visit as well. So that really fast-tracked everything. I kept staying at my home in Marrickville for some time before I moved into Kirribilli when I was in Sydney. But I got to go to the lodge probably 2 weeks after the election, I think. And the lodge, I'd never been upstairs in the lodge before. I had no idea what to expect. There's lots of little rooms off two main corridors. There's like two wings almost to it. It's a lot bigger than my old house, let me say that. And there are still elements when I wake up there at the lodge, and it hits me, the significant change which is there. The Kirribilli, of course, the Cooks River is a beautiful river, but it's not quite
Sydney Harbour. Not quite Sydney Harbour.
So it's very different, that dynamic, plus the whole dynamic of a lot more is done for you as the Prime Minister. I'm incredibly self-sufficient, the way that my home has always been. People get a shock who visit me at home and see everything being very neat and in place. And my world is very different now, and that's something that
takes some getting used to.
And I hope in a way that I never get used to it.
Yeah.
Because once you get used to it, you're taking it for granted. And a whole lot of things that make your life easier, which are common sense to make your life easier, are things that other people spend a lot of time organising and putting in place. The security arrangements, the arrangements to get me from A to B. You don't fly commercially, in part because of security issues, but it means you can get from A to B easy. I flew on Friday. I flew from Devonport to Bendigo. I don't know that many planes have ever gone from Devonport to Bendigo.
No, it's not a conventional route, no.
It's certainly not a commercial route that's about to open up.
Yeah.
But that means you can get a lot more done. It's an efficiency mechanism as well.
And President Obama said in this piece that the thing that he found that changed the most for him was, just on your point, right, that a lot is scheduled for you, a lot is done for you, in order to keep you doing the job you need to do, right? He said that the big change for him was that sort of almost all spontaneity left life. You lost those opportunities where, you know, you wake up, you come to at 10 p.m. and you need a Magnum, and you go down to the 7-Eleven and you get it, right? And then you bump into someone and you hear a story, and and that sort of sets your evening on another path or sets you thinking in another way. He said just all of that from life just went, and he found that quite disorienting at a human level. Is similar, different?
Oh, it is. I'm one of those people who would shop for what they were cooking that night.
Yeah.
And now I can't just drop into a shop. If you need something, I need a bike pump at the moment.
Well, if anyone could send the Prime Minister a bike pump, I'm sure he'd be very grateful.
I have for the bikes there at the lodge, I look at it, but I need to plan, and there needs to be an advance party to the bike pump shop.
No, exactly. Exactly.
It is much more difficult. So I've done things like it sounds absurd, but I bought like enough shampoo and vitamins and
knowing you, this does not sound absurd.
For like at least 6 months.
Yep.
Because going to the shop is
just requires a massive
difficult.
Requires massive effort.
A major effort. Yeah. Buying people Christmas presents. Mm. I can't just go from shop to shop to shop in the way that you would normally do. You just wander around. But it is something that can be frustrating. You can't just drop into the pub, is what I used to do. Mm. And you would meet people who, I know people at various establishments around the Inner West where I could always find someone to, hey, do you want to drop up for a beer and a game of pool?
Mm.
It's far more complex these days to do that.
And in terms of obviously it's necessary, right, and which was sort of your point, it's necessary, but it changes your life in all sorts of ways. And sort of like pivoting now to the style of leadership that you're exhibiting in the first several months of the government, which is, I think I'd use the word ensemble leadership, right? It's not just you. There's other players on the stage.
Collegiate is the term that I'd use.
Well, it's something sort of vaudevillian about it, though, but in a good way. But anyway, so it's sort of like those things need to change. But I suppose the risk for you as Prime Minister, particularly a Prime Minister who has sort of organically networked your entire life, right, the job can cut you off. The job can, because people start lying to you, right? Like they don't want to offend the Prime Minister, so they lie. They don't necessarily tell you what you need to know or what you need to hear. They self-censor. Do you have any of that sense that people are sort of changing around you courtesy of the status of the office, or have you not noticed much of that?
Look, there is a change in how people who see you on the street address you, obviously. You go from some recognition to a lot more recognition. But people, I think part of the Australian character is that people will just treat you as who you are. And I'm the same person and I try to stay grounded. I have very consciously, though, done some things that seem as though they'd be more difficult than they actually are.
What do you mean?
Like I continued to play in the Sydney Badge Tennis Comp last year, and I've enrolled again this year. Now, I won't be able to play every week, and I'm a reserve. The comp goes for 14 weeks, but hanging out with people who I've known for years at Marrickville Lawn Tennis Club, I'm just me there. Like, I'm not treated any differently there from how I was treated beforehand. I just come to the club with additional friends these days.
Yes, some friends from the constabulary. Yes, don't mind my friends.
So I think that's really important, and I have a bunch of people I grew up with who I still keep in contact with and engage with. I spoke with my best friend from primary school, I spoke with last week. And I think that engagement with people who are not part of the system is really important, that you maintain those connections. I didn't make a lot of rugby league games last year, but at South, I'm just the same person I always was and hang with the same people I've hung with for a long time. There, I think you have to make a conscious decision to do that, and I tried to do that. It is difficult in this job because some people who you meet with will, I guess, hold their fiery, their views on things. But there's enough people around me as well. I have a very strong core of people, political friends, who will tell me exactly what they think as well. Mm. Now, some of those work in this building, but many of them don't. Many of them are just people who work in private or public sector jobs who I continue to engage with and catch up with, not as much as I used to because I'm busier. Mm. But I think that's really important as well, to have people who will tell you if they think that you've got it wrong.
Mm. And in terms of the, I don't suppose you want to name names, in terms of who's around in your orbit, who's been influential for you in the transition?
I think people will see who they are and will know who they are, really, the key members of the government, but also people like Tim Gartrell and the people who have worked with me for a long period of time.
Yeah, and you brought people back too. Yep.
Yeah, and some people came back who worked for me when I was last a minister. But there's a bunch of people in this office who I have been friends with and engaged with professionally as well for a very long period of time. There are three or four people I went to university with and was active in Young Labor with in the 1980s. Nathan's godfather works in this office now. He had never worked for me before. He agreed to come and to bring his expertise outside of this building for decades into this office. And that brings me a sense of trust. But as well, they're people who'll tell me exactly what they think as well. I have tried to surround myself with people who are not just yes people, but who have ideas and capacities, and part of that capacity is to be honest about their views. And one of the reasons why I doubt whether there's anyone in this building who has as many long-term staff as I do, I think that says something about the culture that I've always cultivated in an office where my name's on the door, but everyone has a responsibility to making sure that the output as good as possible.
Everyone has some ownership, which again brings us back to the ensemble and this sort of retro return of, you know, government by cabinet. You know, your ministers are, well, they appear to be, I don't know, maybe there's all kinds of fur flying behind the scenes and foot stamping and everything else, but everybody seems to be owning their own portfolios, running policy in their areas, and you're not styling yourself in messianic terms, at least not yet. Like maybe you will grow so enormously fond of yourself that you'll need to burst through and, you know, be at the centre of everything. While you are clearly running the show, all these other people are out and about prosecuting agendas in a leadership sense. Like, how does that work? How do you facilitate that?
Leadership isn't about thinking that you always know best. Leadership is about listening as well as leading. And the capacity of people in the ministry that I have is just exceptional. You have a bunch of people who have served as senior ministers in the government of past, Penny Wong, Tony Burke, Chris Bowen, Katie Gallagher as chief minister of the ACT, people who have not served as ministers before, like Ed Husic and Anne Arley and Christy McBain, really serious people coming through, and then an incredibly talented backbench as well. And I think the job of leadership is to maximise the capacity of the organisation that you lead. And you do that by having faith in people, making clear what the overall direction of the government is going to be, but also recognising that you can't run a federal government from the PMO. You have to have faith not just in people who are elected members of the cabinet, the ministry, the caucus, but also of the public service, maximising the respect that you give them. You'll get more out of them if they are focused on achievement and they know that they are valued. On staff as well, the same attitude I have in the office here as well. I encourage that openness and engagement from officers across the board. And when we had the Christmas party here at the end of last year, we had just at one of the areas down there, the National Portrait Gallery, the feeling in the room of that sense of, in ideological terms, that sense of collectivism was tangible. You could feel it. And that sense of being a part of something big, which being in government provides you with the opportunity to achieve. So I made the very conscious decision that I would, when I became opposition leader, lead in the way that I wanted to lead in government, because I think that it flows naturally through. So Tony Abbott, some people would argue, was a successful opposition leader. Sure, if we go back and find a podcast, we would have discussed this in the past. Mm-hmm. He was not my role model, because I think that the way that he acted as opposition leader meant that when he came into government, it was impossible to just flick a switch and go to governing, because it was a negative response.
It was a different mindset.
I wanted to lead in a positive way and to encourage genuine discussion, which I did in the shadow cabinet, and the cabinet and its processes, the National Security Committee, the Expenditure Review Committee, the other committees of cabinet, and our processes are working in a way in which there is a spirit of cooperation, a spirit of respect. You've got to enable people to say something that is inappropriate and not the best suggestion without them being ridiculed or having a go at them. You'll only get a good idea if people are allowed to come up with a bad idea and have a debate about it as well, rather than everyone being silent and worried about
saying the wrong thing that. Or whatever. But also, though, I mean, just as a, you know, you're at the head of the queue, and you're right, there is this sort of sense of esprit de corps, certainly in the government, but obviously the long-term risk, or well, not even the long-term risk, given the way time accelerates in politics, right? It's sort of like you've got to manage rivalries, competitions between individuals, because everybody wants to advance, everyone wants to succeed. So, you know, how conscious are you of that? I mean, obviously we're only 6 months in, but
it's a competitive business. That's the truth. And that can often be difficult for people to manage. Part of my management style is to give everyone respect for everyone to be able to contribute, not to there to be just a small inner circle who get to dominate.
Mm.
And I think that if you look at what people are saying about the former government, I mean, the absurdity of going so internal and so such a concentration of power so that the former Prime Minister chose to appoint himself to the multiple ministries as the opposite of leadership from my perspective, because ministers clearly didn't even know that was going on. So I'm pretty transparent about the way that we're doing things in the cabinet, and it goes back to 2019. I read recently for someone who's doing another task, a book, read the speech I gave on the day I became Labor leader. So that's kind of what we put in place. That's the template. And then the big speech I gave during 2019 when we had the review of these are the four stages, this is what we will do, and we did that and took people into our confidence as well, said that publicly. I said, for example, we would have our 2030 target after Glasgow.
Mm.
I said that well in advance. That's a risk to do that because people know what you're doing. But here again, we're mapping out for, we'll get into the policy stuff, but for 2023, we've mapped out. We will are doing national security issues here in the first quarter, the Defence Strategic Review, other activities. We have other reform agendas that we're taking through in the lead up to the budget. In May.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then in the second half of the year, we will have the referendum saying well in advance of what the timetable of that will be and the processes leading up to that. We've got the we'll get into those as well. But I think doing that gives people the confidence that they're valued, that their ideas are worth putting the effort into, and there are no ministers that are not performing, in my view. And that's extraordinary that 30 people, many of whom have never done this job before and many of whom have different jobs than they've ever done before, are managing to deliver outcomes and change and do positive things for the country. You would expect that if you pick 30 people, then there's going to be
ups and downs, a spectrum.
But there's no one that I look at, and I've gone through with all 30.
You've done performance reviews.
What the plans are for
charter letters
this
and so
year,
on.
And what the plans are, what it looks like in 2025 as well, and that I find I get a great deal of satisfaction for how the government has begun, you know, on the front foot, and I think people are responding in that really positive way.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's do some issues now, and I think you've basically identified the ones that I want to talk to you about. I want to talk to you about The Voice. I want to talk to you about the Defence Strategic Review, because I'm not sure that the Australian community really has their head around that yet and how big that is potentially, and also just anyway, we'll get into some other issues, but let's just start with The Voice, right? Can you win this thing if Peter Dutton says no?
Well, I think that the question's wrong, and that's the first thing. It's not a matter of you, as in me. So, you know, this is an opportunity for Australians. I have the same vote that you do, that every person listening to this podcast does. This isn't something that's my idea. This is something that was first mentioned in the 1990s, came together, this current process really began in 2012. There was a five-year process leading up to Uluru and then since then. So this has come from the bottom up, from meetings of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders peoples saying, one, the what is recognition. in the Constitution, the how is through a voice to Parliament is what they want, and they want that to be constitutionally enshrined. Now, it's something that I'm strongly, strongly supportive of and incredibly committed to. And I have faith that the Australian people, when they go into a ballot box, will vote yes.
Is there any universe, and I'm sorry to sort of ask two negative questions to start with, because it's sort of, in a way, it's the wrong tone, but these are really essential points, right? Peter Dutton may say no.
And, oh, absolutely. And I think there are internal dynamics in the National Party, in the Liberal Party, and in the Greens Party. In part, what we're seeing is their internal mechanisms playing out.
So, yeah. I mean, you're right to chip me and say, I, Anthony Albanese, am not the single winner or loser of this, you know, of this process. You're right to chip me.
Well, that's important. I don't do it out of any gratuitous means. It's important that Australians know that, and this is what gives me optimism. It's about showing respect for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, and the wording, the draft wording that I've got out there says, in recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders as Australia's first peoples. That's how it begins, the recognition. So it's respect for them. But it's also about how we perceive ourselves as Australians. I think Australians will get a great deal of satisfaction by celebrating the fact that we do share this great land with the oldest continuous culture on earth, and that will be a positive thing for people to embrace. And thirdly, of course, it's also about the way that the world sees us as well, whether we're a mature nation, whether we're prepared to acknowledge our history.
Of course, but the point is, you know, rather like the marriage equality debate, I mean, obviously quantifiably different, but analogous in this sense, right? In the marriage equality debate, the majority decides the rights of the minority. We're going through another process now where the majority decides the rights of the minority. And because of the history of the country, what I'm trying to say is, in the event that Peter Dutton says no and decides to make an issue of this, decides to blow this up, you've got to countenance the possibility that the referendum fails, because that's what history tells us.
Of course, referendums have historically failed more than they've been successful.
Exactly. So can I ask you this? Because obviously you as Prime Minister have to obviously try and move the country forward, but you also have a responsibility to the citizens of the country, including to First Nations people. Mm. Is there a universe in which you would countenance stepping back from the referendum if you judged it was not going to be successful?
To not hold the referendum is to ensure that it's not successful.
So is the answer no?
No is the answer, because it of course is a risk to hold a referendum where at the moment it is only the Labor Party that is saying that they are committed to a yes vote.
Mm.
But it's like worrying about winning a grand final, so therefore you don't run on the field and forfeit. And that's essentially what it is. It would be forfeiting the opportunity for recognition in the form in which Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are asking for.
So this process is locked and loaded. When are we likely to see the referendum? I mean, you're not obviously going to tell me the date today that the campaign starts, but when do we expect it?
Well, the timetable can be worked out pretty easily because you have the machinery of referendum. There's legislation at the moment. There's a committee report will come down in the next week or so when Parliament resumes, and then that will be debated and carried, I would hope, because we haven't had a referendum this century, so that's got to be updated.
Yep.
So that's the first process. Then the process. The referendum working group is meeting in a couple of days' time. It's continued to work through, along with there's a constitutional advisory group of eminent lawyers, former High Court Justice,
yep,
and others working those issues through.
And they're looking at the wording of
that. They're looking, yep, at the wording. They're, yep, looking at all of that.
Yep.
You will have legislation introduced during this period of sittings. So before the end of March, there will be legislation introduced to the Parliament that will have in it the draft wording to be debated. There will be a parliamentary inquiry in which people can make submissions to it, which will go for at least 6 weeks.
Yep.
And then during the budget sessions that begin in May and then June, you will have that debated and voted on and hopefully pass. It needs to pass.
Yes, in order of course, it's a precursor of the referendum happening at all.
In order,
yes,
to have a vote.
Yes.
So the Parliament will have a say and every parliamentarian will have a say, yep, and there will be a parliamentary process of a committee report leading up to that as well. So that takes you up to June.
Yeah.
And then once the legislation passes, it has to, according to the Act, be at least 2 months and 33 days.
Yep.
Don't ask me why that particular figure's in there, because that makes no sense to me, why, sure, it's not 3 months. But anyway, it's 2 months and 33 days.
Yep.
I guess a bit like the 33 days for a federal election.
Exactly.
I assume that's why.
Mm-hmm.
Has to be between that period and 6 months.
So then it's sort of September, isn't it? Thereabouts. August,
between September and December.
Yeah, between September and December.
So that's the time frame.
Okay.
Which is there, but it's also the process. Like this is that is one of the furphies that's out there, is that somehow there's not enough information. There is this whole process, and the danger of this as well is that people get, you know, overloaded with information, and, you know, there's going to be an opportunity for that to occur. What's interesting is that I put forward the draft wording in July of last year at the Garma Festival. That's what people are actually going to vote on. I haven't had any member of Parliament yet.
Yeah, come up with
a single change of any word that's been put forward.
What about just on the sovereignty question, because the Greens Senator Lydia Thorpe has raised this, and we saw in the Australia Day marches, Invasion Day marches around the country, there was a fair bit of purchase about this point at the grassroots level. She's concerned that saying yes to the voice is tantamount to Indigenous people ceding sovereignty. Does the government, I could see it, I'll just tell you, everybody listening, you should see the Prime Minister's face. Look, there's a specific question. Do you have legal advice from the Solicitor General or eminent legal minds that basically can guide the government on this question? Is there any risk that sovereignty is ceded?
No, look, of course we have legal advice about the whole range of questions, and indeed the wording itself that's put up isn't words that, you know, I sat down in a room and came up
of
with.
Course, so obviously,
all of these issues, people looking for a distraction is probably the wrong word, but there are some people who either when they are of a hard right position or a hard left position come to the same conclusion and are clearly cooperating of not providing support for what is being proposed overwhelmingly by, you can call it the mainstream, call it the overwhelming majority of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples in the lead up to Uluru and ever since. The remarkable thing that has occurred in the stages of this process has been that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who haven't always agreed on a range of issues are on the same page.
But it's not
Not everyone is on the same page. this is not a radical proposition. And I said the other day, it's not a radical proposition. It's not surprising that some people who are on the radical positionary, you know, you have also a range of positions being put forward, which also won't be advanced by this. This isn't going to mean
like
that
power of veto or that sort
all,
of stuff.
All of
you
that.
Mean.
It won't have power of veto. It won't be a funding body. It won't run programs. It won't also mean that people's backyards is threatened. And so you will have people from opposite starting points, but they end up at the same point.
Yeah.
And that isn't unusual in civil politics.
No, that's right. And look, and some people obviously will oppose this because they are opposed to it and will find whatever means of injecting that opposition, right? But these are basic questions. I just want to go just again to sovereignty, just so that we're clear.
Well, this isn't about that. Isn't about that, Catherine. So you can go down rabbit holes. I'm not going to assist you.
No. It's not in this sense, right? I think that there will be people in the community who hear that message, who hear that the voice means
there
we accept the white man's constitution.
But and history has – one of the things that Noel Pearson speaks about very powerfully is that there are three parts, if you like, to Australia's history, and all of them can't be just erased. One is Indigenous ownership of – this land for 65,000 years.
Sovereignty never ceded.
The second is the fact that the first fleet arrived in 1788 and that changed our history. And yes, there are some negative things with that, but there are also incredibly positive things with that as well. And that is important to acknowledge as well. And the third is that particularly in the post-war period, the multicultural development of the modern multicultural diverse society, which we have here. Now, there are some people who want everything post 1788 to be erased. That is not my position. Mm. That is not the government's position. That is not something either, which in my view is a constructive way to move the nation forward.
No, sure.
We share this continent. Everyone has a place in this continent. And some of the debates that take place are put forward views that I don't share. And that is why some of the debates that people are looking for, whether they be in some of the views that were put forward on Australia Day, I don't think that Lydia Thorpe's views are representative of a majority of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, and I don't think they're representative of a majority of Greens voters either.
Sure, but just in terms of just one more and then we will move off this, but I agree with you that the sovereignty point and the voice are two separate propositions. It's sort of like ships in the night. But the point is, you know, it's a reasonable question to ask, what is the impact of the voice on this sovereignty question, because obviously Indigenous people say sovereignty was never ceded. Is there anything associated with the voice that obviates that point?
It's about our history and it's about what it's about. And the sort of argument that is taking place is a bit like some of the debate from others as well, saying what is the impact on definition of Aboriginality. Mm. There are a whole range of questions, which was one of the questions that Peter Dutton was putting forward. There are a range of questions, Catherine, which are not what this referendum is about. And one of the tactics to defeat the referendum is asking so-called questions which have nothing to do with what this referendum is about. This referendum is about two things, recognition and consultation. That's what it's about, recognising Indigenous people in our constitution who currently aren't recognised, and secondly, that Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islander people should be consulted about matters that affect them.
Okay.
That is what it is about.
All right. Let me move on to unhelpful questions on defence. no, I'm joking. No, obviously the Defence Strategic Review is coming. Can we start with a conceptual question and then I've got some specifics. How do you see the threat environment at this point in time?
We live in an insecure world. We have a land war taking place in Europe where a large country has invaded a much smaller, less powerful country, which has sovereign borders, which has a democratically elected government and is attempting to change the circumstances there through brute force, mm-hmm. through an illegal invasion. We have a strategic competition in our own region with two great powers now, the United States and People's Republic of China, with competition in the region.
Mm. So dangerous? Is that if you had to describe it in a word?
I don't think that one of the things that the Biden administration said when Joe Biden became president, and my government has reflected as well, as try not to reduce foreign and international relations to single words.
No, of course. But
it is an insecure world in which we need to put in place measures that increase peace and security in our region.
Well, just picking up on that point, do you think that Australia needs to think more seriously than we have in the past about self-defence?
Yes. Put simply, yes, we do.
And so what does that mean?
What that means is the reason why we're having the Defence Strategic Review run by Angus Houston and Stephen Smith was what are the assets that Australia needs to defend ourselves or to deter any action against ourselves? Where should they be located, and how is that best dealt with in terms of our capacity?
Yep.
So it's not necessarily just about, we spent so many dollars. Was that the best use of every dollar?
What are we spending the dollars on and it is, so on?
Is a change from the former government who had massive blowouts and a failure to deliver in many cases what was committed to.
So will this require this enhanced self-defence? Will this require more defence spending in total? I mean, look, because obviously in a budget, you spend money, you save money, right? In terms of defence spending, what are we looking at? Are we looking at more defence spending with not many offsets, or what are we looking at?
Well, I won't go through the budget process with you on your podcast here, Catherine, but I think it's fair to say that there certainly won't be less. But we also are looking at appropriate value and making sure that our capacity is increased.
So what that means is that some projects may be advanced, but maybe others are terminated or...
Well, that we're working through those issues, but it just means that when you're spending a dollar, is it going to the right place?
Yep.
Is obviously what a Defence Strategic Review is. And we know that there's been a change in the warning times, if you like, of when conflict might occur as well. And that changes some of the dynamic. It was sort of you
mean would, it reaches you faster
a,
than...
Yeah, you would have a 10-year window of conflict. That's not necessarily the case anymore. Indeed, well, it's not the advice.
No.
So we need to make sure that we have the right assets, We're examining that. We're working through the AUKUS arrangements with the United Kingdom and the United States. But we're also looking at our capacity in general here as well.
And
I'd put it in a framework which is even broader than the one that you started with, which is that one of the lessons of the pandemic is, in general, we need to be more self-reliant. We need to be less vulnerable to international shocks, which might be a health shock through a pandemic. It might be a cyber issue. It might be a supply chain issue, or it might be military conflict.
Or it might be unreliable alliance partners. If we think about the United States, is Joe Biden going to be there after the next election?
Well, that, of course, is a matter for the people of the United States. If you look at our interdependency in a whole range of areas, the pandemic should have given
everybody a wake-up call.
In the United States, the Inflation Reduction Act is a major, major reform that will see the US become more self-reliant. If you look at the range of areas, including the transition to renewables, you know, we need to make more things here.
Mm.
When you look at access to pharmaceuticals, we need to make more things here. When you look at heavy manufacturing, we need to make more things here.
And defence capability feeds into that.
And defence capability is a part of advanced manufacturing that has spin-offs as well.
Can I ask you a question that I have always wanted to ask you and I've forgotten to ask you on a number of occasions? Just with AUKUS, which you mentioned a minute ago, obviously it's pretty important eventuality, let's call it that. Would Labor have pursued AUKUS if Scott Morrison hadn't, in essence, walked down that path and committed Australia to nuclear submarines from the US?
AUKUS is not just about nuclear submarines.
Sure.
That's important.
Yeah.
It's about our defence arrangements, it's about interoperability. It to me seems when we had the decision to make, and I as Labor leader was surprised by some of the analysis, which seemed to forget that there's nothing, if you take a step back, there's nothing terribly surprising by us having relations with the United States and the United Kingdom.
No, sure.
The United States alliance was forged during World War II, really, by Curtin, who turned to America in 1941 when it was so critical. And then the alliance formally grew out of that over a period of time. And the United Kingdom, of course,
is a very important part of our history as well. Hang on. But my question, though, isn't, does Labor want to do something with our alliance partners? That's not my question. My question is, would you have done AUKUS?
Well, we weren't. That's a hypothetical question.
Yeah, but it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's a sliding door moment. So do you think that...
No, I think that there would have been what your question leaves out, I guess. It sees AUKUS as being an arrangement between politicians. AUKUS is an arrangement between nations who are friends. Whoever was in government would have had similar...
So you think you would have got there anyway?
Similar defence departments, defence personnel, foreign affairs advice. And that's why our relationship with both those nations has been pretty consistent over a considerable period of time, regardless of who's been
government in
office at any particular time.
No, sure. And it's not a trick or a trap question.
No,
I'm just genuinely interested. You think you would have got there anyway?
I think, we obviously weren't a party to the arrangements, and that was a decision that the former Prime Minister took, even though he was asked to
consult more widely
the opposition in it, but he chose not to do so. That says something about the United States as well and its understanding of the relationship between our two nations, that it wasn't a relationship between political parties.
Yeah.
It was much deeper than that. And that's why the relationship is, I think, is so important.
What's our interim solution? Because obviously these submarines, and we've made the point in this bit of the conversation, obviously, that, you know, the defence review is about more than AUKUS, obviously. So,
yeah. Right. Well, we're working through.
What's the interim solution?
We're working through
those solutions. Well, you could share it now with the podcast listeners.
And we'll be having appropriate announcements.
Yes. When?
Given appropriate processes,
yes,
that we'll work through.
So you haven't decided
yet? Our cabinet.
You haven't decided yet what the interim solution is?
Oh, we've decided a whole range of things, but one of the things that I've decided, even more significant than that, is the way that this government will operate, which is that we operate properly, we have proper processes, we'll go through all of that. The cabinet will confirm decisions that are made, but the National Security Committee has been meeting regularly. We've been meeting already this year and we'll continue to engage. We have our Foreign Minister and Defence Minister as we speak.
Yes, in Gay Paris.
Overseas, meeting with their French counterparts and then the United Kingdom counterparts as well. We'll be having a discussion, and there's already been significant discussions with our friends in the United States.
And but timing, like approximately, obviously. I'm deeply disappointed for the record that you're not going to unveil the AUKUS interim solution on the pod.
Unveil everything on the pod.
On the pod.
We'll probably do it in a broader
context.
A broader forum and perhaps in consultation
with the allies, sure. But what's the timing?
Well, we've said in the first quarter of this year.
But it's weeks.
We've said
months.
In the first quarter.
Oh, God.
So
I'm getting nowhere with these questions.
What's a quarter of 12, Catherine? Three.
Yes, yeah, I know. Well it's either weeks or months, isn't it?
We're already in the last day of January.
Okay.
So therefore.
Okay, it's not the end. Well, look, there, yeah, another couple of months. Okay, at some point in the next couple of months. Will you either go to Washington or Beijing this year, do you think?
I fully expect to. Well, I will be going to the United States this year.
Mm-hmm. When?
On at least one occasion, and we'll make that announcement at an appropriate time.
Hopeless.
Because that is, well, I will be going to the APEC meeting that's being held.
Yes, in the US, that's
in
right.
In the United States in
October?
San Francisco in either October or November. Mm. They haven't finalised the date yet.
Yep.
So perhaps you can.
Yes, you will be going to
get on to them and finalise
sure,
it.
Sure. You will be going to APEC, but I'm talking about.
But I will be going to the United States before then.
Okay, before APEC.
Before then.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay, and Beijing.
President. Well, I don't have
one must
a
be
scheduled
invited.
Meeting
yes.
there. President Biden has invited me to the United States, and President Biden will be here in Australia. As well, this year, of course, at the Quad Leaders meeting.
Of course, yeah, of course.
With Prime Minister Kishida and Prime Minister Modi.
Yes.
And I have extended to the President an
addressing
invitation when he comes to address the Parliament.
Is that likely, do you think?
Well, we're hopeful. It depends upon diaries, and we haven't finalised the arrangements for the Quad Leaders meeting yet, the timetable. That will be done as soon as possible. Mm. There are a range of logistics
they would be unfathomable.
Which are extraordinary, but we have a draft provisions are in place of a venue and timing as well. But we'll wait and
watch this space.
See confirmation.
No, of course. And I'm very conscious you've been generous with your time and I appreciate it. And we must be absolutely on the clock by now. Just budget, just a couple of things. Obviously,
there will be one.
Yeah, well, not only one, there'll be two. There'll be two. We did one in October and one in May. There will be two in the same financial year because, you know, this government is glutton for punishments. Anyway, no, obviously there will be.
We've got to give you something to talk about.
Sure. No, I'm totally up for the budget. I'm pumped. So obviously that's in May. Now, there will be two things. Obviously, energy rebates because of high energy prices will be a feature of that budget, given the agreement you made, you know, over December in terms of rolling that out with the states. So there's a cost of living component in the budget. But there will also be, I'm sure you're acutely conscious, and I can't wait for you to roll your eyes at the question, a drumbeat amongst, you know, well-meaning NGOs and others about the stage three tax cuts. We had this debate in October. We had a precursor debate about whether or not this was the most appropriate. I know you're aware of the debate. The question's coming. In May, is there any universe where the government adjusts, because you're not talking about scrapping them. I've never heard anyone talking about scrapping them. Is there any universe where that package gets adjusted in May?
We have not changed our position.
Yeah, but that doesn't actually answer the question.
It does, actually.
Well, then can you express it more affirmatively, because we haven't changed our position.
It's exactly what we said last time. Mm-hmm. And
so is the answer no?
Nothing has changed.
Is the answer no?
There's no debate going on about changing any arrangements for those things in May. And we have not changed our position.
Is the answer no? Is the answer no?
We are focused on, but then you get into Catherine asking hypotheticals about a range of things on the budget.
No, you know, you've
been around for a long time, Catherine.
Look, I'm thank you.
And you know that people do not respond
to
budget questions. That way. People can go and
speculate to their heart's content. Not very productive speculation, if you've got no intention.
It wasn't last time.
No.
And it won't be this time.
It won't be in May.
Well, I haven't changed our position.
Right.
We have not changed our position.
Right. Is there any universe where the position
might be changed?
You
can ask the same question a different way, but you'll get the same answer.
No, sure, but the persistence isn't madness. The persistence just reflects the fact that the locution is slightly open-ended. You're basically saying we haven't changed our position, which doesn't preclude changing your position if you feel differently in a week's time.
Well, Catherine, this is I've noted that the coalition are out there running a campaign one way, and some other people will be out there running a campaign the other way, and this is all about something of which a decision in May will have zero impact.
Right. Oh, well, that's as definitive as I think we can get on that point.
No, but we have not changed our position.
Okay. In the budget, apart from the energy rebates, cost of living is a problem more generally, obviously, for people. 7% or whatever that dreadful inflation figure was the other day. More interest rates rises coming down the pipe. Obviously, the government has been concerned about overheating the economy by putting more cash handouts or whatever in the mix. But what is most front of mind for you?
Our cost of living is a big issue, which is why we designed the energy policy the way that we have, in a way that would take pressure off inflation, but also the fiscal position of the budget that we inherited with $1 trillion of debt and not much to show for it, is something that requires discipline. It requires a responsible budget, which is what we delivered in October, and we'll deliver that.
More savings. More.
Again, in May, there are enormous pressures, spending pressures on the budget.
Mm.
One of them we've discussed is defence.
Yeah.
Another is the NDIS.
Yeah.
Another is
health.
Aged care
health.
And health issues. There are other pressures on expenditure, and one of the pressures on expenditure on the budget is debt that we inherited, where the increase in interest rates impact how much has to be paid on the debt, which is there as well. So that places increased pressure as well. So we are conscious about that, but we'll continue to work. The ERC is doing its work. We met this week. We met last week. We'll meet next week.
Mm.
Continuing to do the work of getting a policy agenda, which one of the things about the Labor Party is there's lots of ministers with lots of ideas. We can't do everything that we would like to do, in our first year. We've been in government for 7 months. We've done what we said we would do, plus some additional reforms like paid parental leave. The expansion of that was in addition that came out of the Jobs and Skills Summit. But we will be responsible in how we do it, because to do otherwise is to be counterproductive.
Mm.
Because if it's not a responsible budget, it could place more pressure.
Overheats the economy, et cetera. Yeah.
So it's counterproductive. So we're very conscious about that, but conscious as well of concentrating on the areas of productive investment that lead to a stronger economy down the track. So infrastructure investment, the National Reconstruction Fund in new industries and jobs, free TAFE. Childcare is an economic participation and productivity measure as well. So we're looking at those productive areas of the economy as well. How we drive productivity will be one of the themes of the budget.
Okay, we might have a conversation sometime after the budget and
I'm sure
see,
we will.
Well, see where the sum of human knowledge leads us.
We might talk to each other before May, surely, Catherine.
Well, yes, I think that's inevitable. Sadly for you, I think that's inevitable. Anyway, thank you, Prime Minister, very much for your time. You've been generous with it and I appreciate it, and I'm sure the listeners will appreciate it. Thank you to you guys for listening. I'm sure you'll be interested in this conversation. You know where the Prime Minister is on social media. You can track him down. You can track me down. And we'll be back next week for the opening of the Parliament.
See you then.
God help us all.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.